Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polacek, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and for those of you that have been listening, sending in questions and comments, thank you so much. And please continue to help spread the word that every Monday from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time, this show will bring you special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases entertain, while bringing answers and options to making your lives happier, healthier, and more successful. Now, this show will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more. And I'll introduce you to talented authors and caring people who are bringing new innovations in the areas of health, security, and fun for you and your family. Now, with my experience working with families in crisis, I've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields who are all working to make this world a better place for all of us. Now, while many of you are expecting to hear my co-host, Dr. Matt Polacek, he's continuing to take a little time off away from the show. But during that time, we're going to be bringing you some wonderful guest hosts who, like Matt, are making a positive difference in the lives of others. Now, my guest co-host today is Harriet Bay. Harriet is an educational consultant who counsels families on the most effective educational setting to meet their particular child's needs. She is recognized as a leader in the field and has broad knowledge of the schools in Los Angeles, as well as many other facilities and programs throughout the country. And she specializes in children and young adults with special needs, seeing each child and family situation as unique, not a one-size-fits-all situation. Now, her background is in education as a teacher and also a family therapist. She received her BA from UCLA and her master's from Cal State Northridge and is a licensed marriage and family counselor for the state of California. She travels extensively to review the differences between certain schools and programs currently available to meet the needs of her clients. She is a member of IECA, which is the Independent Educational Consultants Association, and NATSAP, which stands for the National Association of Therapeutic Schools and Programs. Harriet, thank you for joining us.
I'm happy to be here.
Well, and for those that don't know, and it might be easier, Harriet, if you could share with our audience exactly what does an educational consultant do and why is it so important to have one when parents are making difficult educational decisions for their children?
It's important because a good example would be parents who have three children. Two of them are doing very well in the school that they're in, but the third one's really struggling. So why is the third one struggling? And that's usually why they come to me and try to figure out what it could be. Very often, it could be something having to do with a speech issue, might need speech therapy, could have something to do with an audio perceptual difficulty, could have a learning difference, and it could be struggling emotionally. So it's my job to kind of figure that out, to recommend possibly that they get intensive testing so I can figure out what direction we should go. You said that I work with kids with special needs. That's true. And it's a really wide variety. Right now, the flavor of the month seems to be kids who are on the autistic spectrum. And so I've really been dealing a lot with that, both locally and across the country. These are children that can be helped, and there are wonderful programs out there. And it's very satisfying. Today's topic really interested me because while not all my parents are difficult, they are dealing with a really difficult situation, and in turn, their anxiety makes them kind of hard to deal with. So I'm really anxious to hear what your speaker has to say about the subject because I encounter it most days.
Well, and I'm looking forward to it as well. And so for those that haven't received our press release, our topic today is also the title of our guest's new book, which is Lessons from a Difficult Person, How to Deal with People Like Us. So our guest, Sarah Elliston, is an expert in the art of dealing with difficult people. She is a top workshop leader and a member of the faculty of the William Glasser Institute, which promotes reality therapy to foster behavioral change. But her instructional career began long before she even became aware that she was herself a difficult person. And she says that those traits began in Lincoln, Maine, where she grew up. Now, for more than 30 years, she has been teaching and training, first as a high school teacher in Ohio, and then as an administrator in the nonprofit sector. Sarah, who holds a bachelor's degree in international relations from the University of Maine and a master's of arts degree in teaching from Brown University. She spent 23 years with United Way's Volunteer Center, coordinating volunteers for city government, training local volunteer coordinators and board volunteers, and managing the volunteer program in its entirety for United Way. Now, she is a certified volunteer administrator, which is the highest level of professional certification known in the field. In addition to her work as a volunteer administrator, Sarah pursued a course of study that would bring her to her current area of expertise. She is now certified in values realization, parent effectiveness training, and reality therapy, serving as a board member and president of the Values Realization Institute. Now, drawing from many sources, our guest's passion is training and designing an experience that allows learners to find a process that works for them to make the changes that they desire. Sarah, thank you for joining us, and welcome to Answers for the Family.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm really happy to be here. You make me sound pretty spectacular. I don't know if I've got any of the answers.
Well, one of the things, and my producer, who's wonderful, Jan, when she told me about your book, I loved it. I thought, what a great topic to be able to talk about, because all of us at some point in time in our life are having to interact with people that we tend to think may be more difficult than others. So I think my first question is, what is your definition of a difficult person?
Oh, wow. Well, usually when someone says who's a difficult person, I say, oh, do you mean you don't have one? Because all of us do, as you say. I think difficult people, typically they're negative. They have what I would call the toxic habits of criticizing, blaming other people, not being responsible for their own lives, complaining, threatening, punishing, bribing, that those kinds of habits. They're often competitive, and I mean the list goes on and on and on of the kinds of behaviors that they exhibit. But they're really, anybody that's driving you crazy would probably fall in this category. And the reason that I wrote the book was because I think we really avoid having conversations with the folks that we find difficult in our lives. I'm not sure how much wisdom I have for your guest host in terms of dealing with these parents under stress. I might have some suggestions. I mean, I do. But it's a little bit different than what I think of as a difficult person.
Now,
I think those parents are a little different. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
They're usually a combination of both. They're being difficult because they're so anxious about their child, but there are also some of them that are truly difficult human beings. So I kind of have to tease that out. And when you're working, I really do have to deal with them. I don't really have a choice. But my question to you would be, in my personal life, people who are toxic and difficult, mm-hmm. I frankly have started to let those people go and not deal with them because life's too short.
Well, that's one of the pieces of wisdom that I was taught in terms of toxic relationships. When Dr. Sidney Simon introduced me to the concept of benign neglect, mm-hmm. So that it wasn't like an abrupt cutting off, but just in a quiet way, just not being as available to those people. But when they're family members or they're people that you work with, or in your situation, when they're parents that you, for whose children you are committed, or to whose children you are committed,
right.
then I think we do end up having to have some kind of a conversation with them. And that's really my goal, is to help all of us and the people who are reading the book to have a conversation around what's difficult,
mm-hmm.
rather than a confrontation, rather than having it be some kind of emotional mess, if you will.
That's a really good distinction.
Yeah, and it sounds like a lot of this is for people to be able to realize that maybe they are that person who is difficult. And so the question
maybe.
Is...
Maybe. It was not my intent. When I wrote the book and when I've done the workshops, it's always been my passion is to help the difficult person in the long run, that if there are people in their lives who are avoiding them because they don't want to have the conversation, I would like to invite those people to reconsider their avoidance and invite them to have a conversation, because as a difficult person, I have much richer relationships now that I know what was annoying people for so long. And so that's really where I'm headed. But I've had a number of people say, gosh, I didn't realize. One woman who came up to me about a week after my book was published, and she had read it, and she looked at me with tears in her eyes, and she said, I never realized what my family was trying to say to me. And it took my breath away. I just had no idea that someone would read it and identify themselves as difficult. So,
Sarah, how long did it take you, when you were told that you were difficult, to acknowledge it? Was it just a one-liner? Was it just all of a sudden an epiphany went off? Or did it take you a while to digest it?
I was lucky in the sense that I'd gotten sober a couple of years before. So I was already in the process of understanding that I wasn't in charge of my world.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the whole process of sobriety is sort of saying, oh, you mean I'm not in charge? Okay, gosh. And then trying to look at the world from the perspective of I'm not in charge of everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first step of which is, I think, difficult. I mean, anyway, it was for me. But having had that couple of years, when I had a supervisor turn to me and say, what you're doing is driving us crazy because, and she was really clear about it, I said, oh, I had no idea I was doing it. When she first started to mention it, I said, I don't know what you're talking about. And she said, well, I'll tell you the next time you do it. And so when I started to act kind of like having a little tantrum at work, I thought it was very private and it was just me, but everybody around me, of course, was experiencing it. And she said, that, what you're doing right now, that has to stop. And I honestly looked at her and said, what am I doing? And she told me. And I said, oh, you're absolutely right. So for me, it was that kind of an epiphany around that behavior. Hello?
Yes, I'm here. Yeah, I'm fascinated by how you're expressing it. I really am. So you really got it pretty quickly.
At that point, I think if I was, when you were talking about, Alan was like describing your experience and you were talking about your work, I had the experience of my son being in a private school and studying Spanish and also playing soccer and doing other things, and having him come home and say, I'm going to drop Spanish because I'm not doing very well, and I don't have time to tutor because I want to play soccer. And I said, whoa, wait a minute. And I got pretty difficult. This was before I realized how people perceived me.
Uh-huh.
And I went into that school. I was a language teacher, and I said, I don't understand. You're inviting him to drop an academic class so he can do the drama and the chorus and the soccer, which is non-academic, and the whole point of being here is academics. This doesn't make sense to me. And besides which, how are you teaching this Spanish class anyway? It doesn't sound like you're really paying attention if 6 weeks in you're suddenly discovering the kid isn't doing his homework. And I think if someone I remember realizing that I was being a difficult parent. I was sort of uh-huh. throwing my weight around, and I was sincerely confused because it seemed like we were at cross purposes here. And when I finally took a deep breath and the teacher showed me how she was doing her language, she said she admitted that she was trying out a new process, and it obviously wasn't working. So that took a little bit of the fire out of my irritation. And we finally negotiated that if he could bring his grade up to a passing grade, then he could drop it in the middle of the year, which is what he ended up doing, and then took it the next year, and everything was fine. But I think of myself as the parent in that situation, and if they had said something about a learning disability or something like that, I think I would have blown my stack, which is probably what you put up with every day.
That's right.
Right. So I think for me, having someone describe the behavior, the actual thing that someone is saying and doing, I think if my husband or the administrator of the school could have looked at me and said, you know, when you raise your voice like that, we understand you're passionate and you're angry, but when you raise your voice like that, we can't hear you.
Uh-huh.
If they had said that, I might have lowered my voice.
Uh-huh.
So what I've learned is, at least for me, difficult people are completely unaware of their behavior. They're not aware of what they say or what they do. Or if they are aware, I was certainly aware I was angry and raising my voice, I thought it was getting me what I wanted. So I wasn't aware of the damage it was doing.
Uh-huh.
And that's one of the things that the first step of dealing with a difficult person from my perspective is to be very clear about the behavior without a judgment. You know, when someone says, well, when you yell and scream and make such a racket, those are pretty judgmental words. When you say, when you raise your voice, mm-hmm. we understand you're passionate, but when you raise your voice with us, we can't hear what you're saying because it creates a wall, it creates a barrier, which is probably something you're already doing, huh?
Right.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you're already saying things like this.
Trying. Yep.
Okay. Now, Sarah, when your supervisor first explained this to you in a way in which it sort of hit home, did you go back then and talk to your family or friends?
Oh, yes.
And what was their response?
I said, did you know I do all this? I said, yeah. My husband and my son said, you know, we're used to it. You blow up, you get upset, you say things you don't mean, and, you know, 5 minutes later, you've forgotten it. And I was stymied. I said, well, isn't it a problem? I said, well, we are used to it. It's not an issue for us. But the most telling point for me was visiting my mother, who was in her, I guess, her late 80s, and she was not a happy person. My father had died about 5 or 6 years before, and she did not like being without him. She her style of being was. Hello, someone wants to say something?
No. Go ahead.
Oh, I keep hearing something in the background, but anyway, she would be very polite, very sweet, very cordial, very wonderful with everybody in her retirement community, and with her family, she would let us know where it was really going on and what was really going on, since she was not a happy camper. And I visited her for a couple of days, and at one point she just blew up at something about a school that she had attended and how angry she was at them, and she stomped around the living room and she shook her finger at me and she walked out of the room, and I thought, ha ha, that's exactly what I've been doing all my life. Is that I honestly, at that point, I had been thinking about it enough that I was saying, how come nobody told me you're not supposed to do it? It was kind of like I never learned how to wear makeup because my mother didn't wear any. Mm-hmm. And I didn't learn really much about sewing and ironing and what folks call it domestic arts because she didn't enjoy doing them. She was an educator, and she... She hired people to do those kinds of things. Well, although, of course, we did some ironing. But the point was, I was saying, I was 50 years old when my supervisor pointed this out to me, and I remember saying to my husband, "How? What? Why didn't someone say something to me when I was 14 or 22 or 35? I mean, where did this come from?" And he said, well, you know, it's just part of who you are. We've all just gotten used to it. Well, and then I saw my mom doing it and realized, well, that no wonder.
Well, now that you've made, Sarah, now that you've made this change, how does your family
hopefully.
Well, I assuming you have. How does your family respond to you now?
Well, I mean, we have pretty good relationships. I mean, I would say that with them, I'm and with others, I check things out all the time. Mm-hmm. I'm more aware of it with other people. If there's a look when I say something or do something, I turn right around and say, whoops, did I say the wrong thing? Was mm-hmm. that offensive to you? Are we okay? You know, one of those kinds of questions. Uh-huh. And what I've been told is, no, you're fine. And one of my friends tells me that I'm a little super sensitive about it. But you know what? Having spent so many years being completely insensitive to it, I am now more sensitive. But my son is fine. I mean, we have a pretty good relationship. He confides in me, and I think my daughter-in-law has a little bit more difficulty with me, but we're very different, and I'm not sure if mothers-in-law are ever beloved.
Well, there are some exceptions. My mother-in-law ended up being my best friend, so you never know.
Oh, I'm so glad. Yeah. I liked my mother-in-law, but I learned not to tell her what I was really thinking because it turned out that she told everybody else.
Oh.
So while I liked her and I appreciated her and I thought she did a great job raising her family and she was an incredibly good cook, I had to police my confidences.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Sarah,
part of...
Well, I was going to say, when you were doing your research for the book, you know, you must have looked at what some of the consequences are for being a difficult person. What are some of the consequences that people are having to deal with that they won't have to deal with any longer if they can make some changes in their own life?
Well, one obvious thing is that, you know, people end relationships with them abruptly sometimes, and one of them is being fired. And I'd been fired a couple of times. Another is, it's hard to describe, but there's a feeling of distance and somehow a lack of connection, even though there are people that you think are your friends. When you start to invite them to do friend-like kinds of things, they're busy or they're unavailable, or you suddenly notice that they're doing them with someone else, for example. Like there's a group of people that we would all go, say, drinking together. When I was first teaching school, we'd all go have a couple of beers on Friday night. Right? And mm-hmm. and then some of us would stay and have dinner. And then I remember saying, well, let's go to the movies or let's do something else. People always seem to have something else they needed to do. You know, so it was, I was okay to be with and to hang out with, but no one got really close to me, or I got close to no one, or that kind of thing. I remember meeting someone at a values clarification workshop that was a week-long workshop where we were fairly intimate in terms of sharing what was going on in our lives. And the woman was a social worker, and she turned to me the second or third day and said, are you always angry at everybody? Do you know that you sound angry all the time? And I had no clue. And I said, I don't know what you're talking about. And I honestly didn't. I never forgot that she said it. But it was at least 15 years before I began to understand what she meant. So I think people who are part of the consequences of being difficult, of course, as I say, are losing relationships and losing jobs, losing marriages probably, and being angry all the time, which is not very comfortable.
No, not at all. So... what inspired you to then write a book about it? At what point did you say, wow, this is something that I need to now share with everybody else?
I was leading workshops. I did a whole bunch of workshops around working with volunteers, but my most popular workshop was dealing with difficult volunteers. And when I left United Way, I no longer was teaching those classes, but I really liked teaching, so I was working as a volunteer coordinator at my church, and I said to one of the ministers, what if I did a workshop on dealing with difficult people? Do you think that would be useful? She said, oh, my God, yes. So I manipulated the model of the workshop and tried it out. I mean, I offered it for free a couple of times just because I wanted to see if it worked, and it did. So I've done it a number of times here in Cincinnati and been invited to other communities to do it. And what I realized, well, people would say to me, do you have the second level? Because the workshop is between 2 and 3 hours. And then they'd say, well, do you have like an advanced class? So when I get home and I have a problem, what do I do? And I always said, well, you can call me, which they often did. But I realized that if I had a book and if I wrote it down and had both the things, the exercises that we did in the classes, as well as some others, that they would have a resource that they wouldn't have to keep coming to me for. So I wrote it. And in the process of writing it, I realized that it was my life experience that was part of why they believed me. Not just because what I'm teaching works, because it's not, I mean, what I'm teaching is everything I've learned from William Glasser and Sid Simon and Tom Gordon, these people that created these other procedures and systems. But because I can say, look, this is who I was and this is what happened. And when I say to someone, your difficult person really doesn't know, either doesn't know what they're doing, or if they know they're doing it, they think they're getting the best payoff they can get. They're not aware of the damage that they're doing. Because I know for a fact I didn't. And so it makes it more believable. So then the book turned into a little bit about me and a lot of examples from my life. But the large part of the book are a series of exercises and strategies to explore on your own as the person wanting to get along with a difficult person, as I call them, the reader, to help the reader reevaluate themselves, reevaluate what the other person's doing, how much of it is it really a problem and how much of it is their own issue, that kind of thing. And then some strategies around how to develop the conversation. I even have a little outline of how a conversation could go, and it includes some scripts, some dialogues of conversations that actually occurred.
Could you
obviously
speak?
Go ahead.
Oh, I was really curious about the red pencil mentality. Could you talk about that?
I sure could.
Okay.
I think we were brought up with this. The red pencil mentality refers to the fact that we were taught, you know, we handed papers in school and you got it back with covered with red marks.
Right.
Which meant, look at all the things you did wrong. And that certainly taught me to always look for what's wrong. And the concept of the red pencil mentality is we're always looking at the world through red pencils. We're not particularly taught in school anyway to look for what's working, to look for what's right. And so we're quick to jump to the things that we see that are wrong. And Dr. Sidney Simon came up with this concept, and he had people, you know, we would sit in a workshop and put our hands up to our eyes, you know, as if they were glasses, and test out trying to make them green pencil glasses. And So it's a matter of becoming aware that when we look at somebody else's behavior, we are usually looking for what isn't working. Now, that's not true for you, because you're looking for the strengths of the child.
Right.
But the parents are looking at, oh, my God, look at the things that they can't do.
Yeah, that's all they can see sometimes, yeah.
Our son, for example, was in a Montessori school from the age of 3 to age 12, actually. He was really lucky. But at the age of 4 or 5, when his friends were all learning to read, he wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a little panicked. And they said, don't worry, it's just not ready yet. And I think he was 6 when one of the teachers just sort of sat him in her lap for about half an hour every morning, and they read some books. He loved to look at books. I mean, we had books, both his father and I are teachers, but he just wasn't ready to learn, and I was a little panicked. And luckily, they really understood the concept of dealing with the whole child, if you will. Mm-hmm. And he was great at cooking. He could chop up a carrot, do all these wonderful things.
What
was a little difficult to focus.
Sarah, what was the most surprising thing that you learned in writing this book?
What a cool question. I should have an answer for this, shouldn't I?
Well, no.
Most surprising thing that I think for me, I realized having written the book that I put away a lot of the demons that I grew up with.
Uh-huh.
In terms of the reasons that I think I was so defensive and so aggressive, if you can be defensive and aggressive at the same time,
mm-hmm.
defensively aggressive, most of my life because of what I perceived was going on in my childhood. And as I wrote it and got clearer and clearer on it, I forgave a lot. I mean, I let go of a lot of the pain of that. And I think I was... Go ahead.
No, that's one.
We're just listening away. Apparently, there's maybe.
Oh, I keep some. There's something where I hear something, and it must be my headset.
Well, I think you've answered it pretty clearly.
Thank you.
I do.
Yeah.
I think get you off the hot seat here. No, really.
Afterwards, yeah. People reading it and then identifying themselves as difficult, that's been the biggest surprise for me.
Uh-huh.
And then one of my friends pointed out that even if you aren't difficult, all of the strategies that I'm including are values clarification strategies where one becomes a better person, hopefully,
mm-hmm.
Whether one is dealing with a difficult person or not, if you take the time to do the strategies. And it does lead to a certain transformation. So it certainly transformed the way I look at myself and my family.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think you bring up a great point is we can all use a little bit of help somewhere. And so to be able to be reminded of certain things, and you've outlined it in the book, I think is great. Now, we're going to take a break, but I want everybody to know that you can reach Sarah through her website, which is SarahElistonConsulting.com. And if you're driving, obviously you can't write that down. You can always go to the Answers for the Family site, and we will have all this information in regards to Sarah on the site. You can also, while we take a break, if you want to pull it up, it's SarahElistonConsulting.com. You can open up another window if you're sitting at your desk, and you can follow along with us. We're going to take a break, and we will be right back. You're listening to Answers for the Family.
Founded over 30 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shield has continually focused on resolving issues that negatively impact families and businesses. Our signature therapeutic transportation service helps to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely transported to specialized schools, programs, and treatment centers with unsurpassed experience and success. We are supported by our full-service, licensed investigation agency that is legally, professionally, and compassionately located hundreds of runaways and teens. We are experienced and qualified to help, offering solutions which may include referrals to our international network of top professionals in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, psychiatry, and investigations. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services and West Shield Investigations are the best solutions when your family is facing a personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's 1-800-899-8585, or visit our website at westshield.com. Thank you.
It's got twisted.
And we're back. I'm Alan Cardoza. With me is Harriet Bay. And our topic today is Lessons from a Difficult Person, How to Deal with People Like Us. And our guest is Sarah Elliston. So, Sarah, we were talking quite a bit about the book itself and the fact that you've written it in such a way that people can read the book And you don't necessarily have to have a difficult person in your life. You don't have to necessarily be a difficult person. There's things in there really for everybody. So when you, give us an example of one of the formats that you have in there that that people can kind of visualize.
That's a good question. Can I say while I'm thinking about it, my website is sarahelliston.com. I just went to sarahellistonconsulting.com, and there's supposed to be a link to sarahellistonconsulting.com, and I can't find that link. So if you could make sure your website says sarahellistonconsulting.com rather than sarahellistonconsulting, I'd appreciate it. People are interested in.
I appreciate that, and we will make sure that's taken care of.
My mistake on that. Let's see. Looking for. I think one of the most powerful concepts and strategies that we can look at is the concept of being in our own business. And this is not something I made up. This is something I learned from Byron Katie, who has created something called The Work. And she talks about three kinds of business, period. There is God's business, there's my business, and there's your business. And my business is everything concerned with me. Your business is everything concerned with you. And God's business is everything else. And a lot of times we get involved in somebody else's business, and we have opinions, and we have certain things we want somebody else to do when it's not our business. And strategy around that is looking at whose business are you in when you're having a conflict with someone. If you're really being responsible for your own behavior, then you're not in someone else's business. But we sometimes blame our behavior on other people or on the weather or, somebody else's issue, somebody else's behavior, and then then we're in their business.
Right.
We're not in our own.
Right.
I think with the parents that Harriet is dealing with, I think it's very easy for them to, I would guess it would be easy for them to jump right into their child's business because they're so anxious to make sure it works, to have them have a positive experience.
That's true, Sarah. Where it becomes a little difficult sometimes is, yes, their child may have an issue, but very often it's the parents that have an issue between them, and they have kind of made the child the identified patient, and that gets a little hairy. That's really becomes difficult.
Yeah, there's a
one of
well, what I want to say there's a term that we use, and one of my companies does the adolescent transport. So we're the ones that are taking them to the program. So when someone like Harriet is working with a family, they decide that this young person would thrive in a particular school, we've gone and as we're talking to the child, and frequently the child will say, well, you don't understand. It isn't me that should be going. I come from a dysfunctional family. And our answer is, well, that's the beauty of the program that you're going to if that's the case. So we're neither buying into it, but at the same time, we can see at times that there are these young people, one of the best things for them is going to be a parentectomy.
Well, yes, and learning these programs will help the kids learn how to become their own person, but also how to deal with their difficult parents, because sometimes they are.
Right. Yeah. Part of being in your own business are the two concepts of the caring habits and the toxic habits that Dr. William Glasser identified. And I know that when people say, "Well, what's the one thing I should know about the book or about relationships?" I always say, if you can live by the caring habits, and there are seven of them, but it's not like we haven't heard them before. They are supporting, encouraging, listening without judgment, accepting, trusting, respecting, and negotiating differences. If you can live by those, so that you ask yourself, wait a minute, is what I'm doing encouraging, or is what I'm doing telling this person what to do? Mm-hmm. Which am I doing here? If you can screen your own behavior to make sure that you're living by those seven habits, you'll have good relationships, period.
Yeah, I think that's great information. And we have a listener question that is coming in that is dealing directly with this issue of family members. This one reads, I was so excited to see this topic, as with so many families, there seems to be always one member who is difficult to deal with. This describes my sister, who meddles and tries to manage everyone in the family. She blows every situation out of proportion so that she can find a way to help solve it. After asking her repeatedly to soften her actions, we have had no choice but to back away from her. Feeling isolated, she is now angry. What do you suggest that we do? We do love her, and we don't want to hurt her, but this appears that hurting her is sort of hurting all of us. And this is from Joni in Utah. Thank you, Joni.
Wow. Great question. Well, my first suggestion is to try and come up with some other words besides calling it meddling. If you just for your own peace of mind, and so when you talk to her about it, to be able to describe what she's doing in a way that's not critical. Obviously, you're feeling critical about her because it sounds like she gets involved in people's business and creates problems. And so the first step is to find a way to describe that behavior. You ask a lot of questions. You start getting involved in our business. Out of caring, we understand it's out of caring, but it's really our business, or it's somebody else's business. So if you can describe the behavior that way, that's the first thing. And then, of course, blowing things out of proportion is trying to be positive, but again, it's critical because she's going to hear that as I'm doing something wrong. And what you want to do is if it's possible, to describe the impact, the result of her getting involved in somebody else's problems, the result of that is that we feel we have to distance ourselves from you, and we don't want to. Now, that might be your statement. I mean, the book kind of is trying to help you arrive at a statement that is as least judgmental as possible. And then you take a deep breath and wait for her to blow up and respond and get defensive and angry and whatever else she is, and you listen to it. You just become not quite, it's not like you ignore it, but it's like you're a sieve and it just goes through and out the other side, because what you want to do is point out how much you love her, how much you want her around, and how much you want her not involved in your business. And even the concept of whose business are you in, our business or your business. Mm-hmm. And I know people who do this will say, but I care about you, so it's my business. And my reaction is, I have a friend who's like this. She cares about everybody. Mm-hmm. And I keep saying, it's really not your business. If they ask you for help, it's one thing. Oh, but people really need my help. Well, you know, they may or may not need your help, but in order for them to be responsible, you need to let them ask for it, not just give it to them without any request.
It seems to me that one of the most important things you're telling them is the concept of listening. I think when a person feels heard and listened to, that kind of diffuses a lot of things.
Yeah, I talk about active listening in the book and listening to what they're feeling rather than what they're saying.
Uh-huh.
So usually it sounds like you're angry,
yeah.
you sound really defensive, you think I'm telling you you're a bad person, that's not true, I'm telling you I love you, and this behavior is an issue.
Mm-hmm.
It's creating problems. Byron Katie also has the concept of what she calls literally listening. It's not in the book. I wish it was, but it's not.
Well, you can write
and
a third book.
I'm sorry?
Now you can write a third book.
Yeah, probably will eventually. The literally listening is when you're there and you're listening to everything they're saying. and you only respond or say something when they ask you a question. So when they run out of steam, if they haven't asked you a question, you're just sitting there smiling and being attentive. And, of course, Byron Katie is so good at this. She doesn't really do a whole lot of facial expressions while she's literally listening. And she would suggest in her training that your goal would be to listen with an appreciative face, but not nodding and shaking your head and, you know, responding the way we all have been taught to do. So I'm afraid I'm not any good at that. I still make facial expressions and nod and shake my head. But it's a wonderful practice to allow someone to talk and just wait until they ask you a question before you say anything.
Mm-hmm.
Because silence occurs, and if that person is stirred up about something, they'll keep talking. And eventually they come around and say, well, what do you think? Well, and that's an invitation, of course.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think I better start working on my poker face then, because
I'm not sure.
I'm definitely one of those that it makes facial expressions and such. And we have another question coming in, and this one reads, my coworkers are always telling me that I am a perfectionist and intense, and that these traits make me difficult to work with. I would like to lighten up, but I guess I'm a little too OCD to compromise on my work product. I would like to order your book if you think it would give me some insight and help. And this is from Barbara in Illinois.
Hmm. Well, if you'd like to lighten up, I think the book might help. Give you a little bit of opportunity to look at yourself. If they say you're a perfectionist and you're too intense, you could always say to them, well, what does that sound like and what does it look like? Because it sounds to me like they're judging your work habits. And if they say something like, well, your perfectionism is that you're always nagging us to do it differently or telling us what we're doing wrong, well, now that's a little different, you know. If that's what's going on, then it's certainly possible that you can change that. You can just stop
doing
that.
Well, they're accusing you of being judgmental.
Yeah.
Well, they are. Yeah. But it's really, if you can, it's really important, whoever's dealing with the difficult person, and in this case, dealing with people who are criticizing you, to say, what exactly do I say? What do I do? What are my actions that lead you to say that? Because if it's just my work that I want to have perfect, then why would they get involved at all?
Mm-hmm.
So my hunch is that the person who wrote this may make comments about their work, or if she's their supervisor, it's kind of her job to make sure they do it correctly. But if they call her perfectionist, then she must be saying things to them that make them feel like they're not doing a good enough job. And so the seven habits here would be encouraging them rather than criticizing. You see what I'm jumping to conclusions. I have no idea what the behavior is that she's doing.
Well, Sarah, I got to tell you, time has absolutely flown by, and we've got about 30 seconds. And there was another question that came in this morning. And if just kind of a quick little answer for this that says, do you think that we have a higher rate of people described as difficult because of the negativity that our media and politicians are focused on? Do you think that's something that's different now than it was 20 years ago?
No, I don't think so. I think we are more aware of it, and the current political climate is allowing people to be meaner to each other.
So I think that's well put. Now, thank you so much for coming on. Again, for everybody out there, if you go to sarahhelliston.com, that's sarahhelliston.com, or as I said, you can go to Answers for the Family, and we will have the information there. Again, thank you so much. For joining us, Sarah.
I enjoyed it, and I enjoyed talking to you, Harriet. Thanks a lot.
All right, and please be sure for everybody out there to put us on your calendar and tune in next Monday when we are joined by Dr. Aaron Leba. author of Joy Fixes for Weary Families, 101 Quick... yeah, exactly. So it's...
we need that.
Yeah, 101 Quick Research-Based Ideas for Overcoming Stress and Building a Life You Love. Now, if you missed or you want to share our show with your friends, please visit our archives of past interviews at answersforthefamily.com. And you may also subscribe or resubmit your name to download your free copy of the Attitude of Gratitude Journal, your 21-day guide to achieving the quality of thankfulness through self-discovery. And the next time you're on Facebook or Twitter, please remember to stop by our page, check out some of our latest posts, and if you like them, like us and continue to spread the word. For everybody out there, be good human beings, have a great week, and we hope that you will be with us again next week on Answers for the Family.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polacek, only on LA Talk Radio.